Hello, and welcome to Parasitology Revisited, a series of revision podcasts for BVMNS graduate entry and infection and immunity students. Mind-altering parasites by Dr. Tudor Jones. Every parasite needs to find a way of infecting new hosts if they're going to survive and spread. Also, the host's immune response will eventually either suppress the parasite's development or remove it altogether. And of course, host will eventually die, either of old age, disease, or get eaten by a predator. Most parasites with simple, direct life cycles just concentrate on producing enormous numbers of infective forms, such as cysts, oocysts, or eggs. These are passed out into the environment, often in host feces, and eventually a very small proportion of them will go on to infect another host. However, parasites with indirect life cycles, especially those that depend on predator-prey relationships, face the uncertainty of how long they have to wait in host tissues until they are eaten. One way of doing this is for the parasite to enter into a hyperbiotic state that allows them to survive in host tissues like muscles for many years. However, the parasite still runs the risk of eventually being destroyed by the host immune response, or if the host dies from old age, another disease, or an accident. So some of these parasites will stack the odds in their favour by altering the behaviour of the host to increase the chance of the predator being able to catch and eat the infected prey. It's not surprising, therefore, that all these behaviour-altering parasites have stages that develop in the brain, where they affect host behaviour either by producing sophisticated chemicals that act on the workings of the brain, or by physically damaging the brain. However, we currently know very little about the details of how these mechanisms work. Now that I've got that general explanation out of the way, I'll concentrate on some examples that you can use in an exam question on modified host behaviour. The first one I'm going to consider is Toxoplasma, an intracellular protozoan with an indirect life cycle that exploits the natural predator-prey relationship between cats and mice. We now have strong evidence that mice infected with Toxoplasma lose their natural fear of cats and in fact appear to be attracted rather than repelled by cat urine. Clearly, this change in behaviour makes it more likely that an infected mouse will be caught by a cat rather than an infected mouse. Some claims have also been made that Toxoplasma infection in humans makes them act more recklessly and more likely to have driving accidents, but of course that doesn't help the parasite as humans are accidental hosts. The next example is Taenia multiceps, a cestode that cycles between canines and sheep, again exploiting a natural predator-prey relationship. In this case, the presence of the large sinuous stage in the brain and spinal cord of the sheep results in a marked unsteadiness of gait, which can ultimately lead to paralysis and blindness. This condition is referred to as GID, staggers, sturdy, or turn sickness, depending on where you are in the world. Clearly, this disabling of the sheep favours parasite transmission, as it would be much easier for the predator to catch an infected sheep when compared to an uninfected one. Because of the large size of the sinuous stage, it's also reasonable to assume that in this case the changes seen in host behaviour are related to the physical presence of the tapeworm larva stage rather than the production of any mind-altering chemicals. But then you never know in parasitology. The last example is Dicrocelium, a trematode with a complex three-host indirect life cycle, involving sheep as the definitive host, with a snail and an ant as intermediate hosts. And in this case, it's the ant's behaviour that gets changed by the parasite. The ant becomes infected by ingesting the cercarial stage of the parasite in slime balls passed out by the snail. Once inside the ant, the cercaria transform into the metacercaria stage, which is infective for the sheep. Most of the metacercaria form in the abdomen of the ant, but one or two migrate to the brain, and it's these that are responsible for changing the ant's behaviour. So what happens here then? These metacercaria in the brain affect two aspects of the ant's behaviour. First of all, infected ants, instead of normally retreating to their burrows as the day cools in the late afternoon or evening, remain on the pasture overnight. Secondly, infected ants climb to the ends of the blades of grass, and when they get there, their jaws lock onto the grass. The effect of these two changes in behaviour means that the ant becomes a prime target for accidental ingestion by the sheep while it's grazing during the day. The even smarter bit comes when, as the day starts to warm up towards midday, something that could put the static ant at risk from desiccation, the jaws now relax and the ant retreats into its burrow. However, the ant remains locked into the same daily cycle over and over again until it gets eaten or dies. So in this case, the parasite is not only altering the host behavior, but also able to modify the outcome in response to changes in the environment that could be detrimental to the survival of the host and therefore itself. So here we have some very sophisticated stuff going on, and we have little, if any, idea of how the parasite manages to do this. In this podcast, I brought together some examples of parasites that modified host behavior to improve their chance of transmission. And I've presented them in the same kind of way as I'd expect you to do so in an exam question on this topic. At present, we know very little about how the different parasites manage to control host behavior, whether it can be reversed or blocked as a means of parasite control, or if any of the pathways or chemicals involved have potential use in human medicine.